you got it dialed in. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
All right, so good to be with you again as we explore the exciting realm of emerging technologies, nanotechnology, open innovation, science, all things of a wonder right here on the promise of tomorrow. Well, today we're going to visit with a guy by the name of Chris McMurrow, who he and Matthew Middleton are hosting the IEEE Green Technology Conference Robotics Competition in the middle of April. The University of Texas at Arlington is where they're actively engaged, and UTA's leadership in robotics research and automation is really outstanding, and we hear all the time about the things that that they're doing. So a lot of really neat things that are happening. If you want to know more about this IEEE Green Technology Conference, it's sponsored by Encore, and you can find out more at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. So if you're going green, you know, be an exhibitor or attend the event at the Texas Resort and Convention Center at the Gaylord Convention Center. This is first-rate IEEE. I'll tip you off to that. And then David Welsh is going to stop in the next half hour, and he's going to tell us about transmission line sensors that are going in for the electrical grid. You're going to want to stick around for that, that's for sure. So more wisdom with another personality in our Den of Strangers, and here are the latest tiny tech jobs, and of course, the end of the next half hour, the voice of reason. But let's get right now to our program. And we have with us today Chris McMurrow. He's completing his master's in computer science and engineering, and he's also heading up, along with Matthew Middleton, the IEEE Green Technology Conference Robotics Competition. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Colonel.
Now, you've competed in past years in robotics competition, and you impressed the people at IEEE so much that they actually put you and Matthew in charge of organizing this year's competition. Can you tell me what you have planned and how it's going?
Yeah, basically this year we're sort of continuing the tradition of the Region 5 IEEE robotics competition. Every year the scope of the competition changes a little bit, but for the most part it's basically the same thing where the students build a robot that takes up a 1 foot by 1 foot by 2 foot area, so, you know, basically the size of a medium-sized dog, and everything is done on a course that's 8 feet by 8 feet, and it usually involves moving some sort of cargo container around, and the competition is done completely autonomously, meaning the robots don't get any sort of outside remote control or direction or anything like that. It's everything is completely pre-programmed, and the robot has to make intelligent decisions along the way.
And you're doing all your work at the University of Texas at Arlington, and this is the first time it's been hosted by UTA, and you're part of the robotics research at the Automation and Robotics Research Institute, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And you're expecting how many teams this year do you think are going to be competing in the robotics competition?
We're expecting about 30 or so teams, probably totaling around 200 students competing.
And the teams can construct more than one robot or a single large robot to accomplish the task assigned to them. Is that right? Can you kind of get into it a little bit about what these tasks are? I mean, is this going to be interesting for people like me to watch, or is it all real scientific and only for pointy heads?
No. It's going to be interesting for people who aren't in the robotics field to watch. So the basic idea of the competition is, it's the Green Technologies Conference that this is going to be held at. So we're putting an emphasis on green technologies, and environmental concerns. So the idea of this competition is the robots move around amongst the playing field, and they're moving around cargo containers, which are modeled as nuclear fuel rods. So the idea is that these fuel rods start out in the middle of the course, and each rod has a certain value associated with it. Now, the rod at the end of the competition needs to wind up in one of the four corners based on the value of that container. And the rod container values are read by resistance. So we actually designed a copper pipe container that has a resistor mounted in the middle. Mm-hmm. And once the value of the resistance is measured by touching the copper pipe, that tells you where the pipe needs to, or where the container needs to end up at the end of the competition. So in addition to moving these containers around based on their resistance values, the corners where the containers need to be delivered are also marked with strobing lights. Now, these lights strobe at a very fast rate to where the human eye, you know, can't tell if they're actually flashing, but they're flashing at a range of 2,000 to 8,000 flashes per second. So the hardware on the robot and the electronics needs to be designed such that they can actually distinguish the different flashing corners from each other and also read the resistance of those containers. So the idea is that these containers are marked and they'll be moved to some sort of location, some sort of, you know, off-site processing facility, as if this were like a nuclear power plant or something like that. And it's ideal to have an autonomous robot do these sorts of things, you know, for obvious reasons. You don't want people near these sort of hazardous things. Now, we also have added a couple of twists to this year's competition. All the previous competitions involved moving some sort of cargo, but this year we have some windmills in the final round of the competition that'll be randomly placed. So we're sort of modeling this as a power generation facility where there's some sort of, you know, hazardous cargo that needs to be moved around, but there might also be some windmills in the area that are providing backup power. So the robot needs to be able to avoid these windmills in addition to moving the cargo around. And we're also adding a neat feature that has never been done before, and that's power efficiency. So we're actually designing a device that the teams, if they want to participate for bonus points, they can basically take this device, plug it in their batteries, and then it will measure the amount of power that they expend throughout the competition. So the most efficient entry that does the task while expending the least amount of energy will actually get some bonus points, and it's enough points to where it can actually sway the outcome of the competition.
So the actual rods are simulated nuclear rods, radioactive, and each one of the rods has a different property that the robot has to recognize and put in a certain place. Is that what I'm to understand?
Yeah, that's right.
And then you've also added some other elements in there as though it were a real power plant because you put some windmills in there. Now, how do the windmills figure into this again?
So the windmills are actually a form of obstacle that the robots need to avoid. And if you picture the competition at you know, some sort of power generation facility out in the middle of nowhere where they maybe have a nuclear reactor and then there might also be some windmills on the facility, you can imagine that it would be very expensive if you know, some sort of vehicle were to crash into one of those windmills, both, you know, in terms of damage to the windmill, but also any sort of, you know, container spill that could happen or hazardous leak. So that's one of the things we wanted to stress in there was these automatic behaviors that the teams program into their robots need to be intelligent to the point where they don't cause a big accident.
Okay. Now, so the windmills are obstacles, and the tubes are simulated radioactive material that it could be dangerous. What happens when one of the robots in the competition fails and trips over a windmill and dumps it? Does that simulate a major accident at a nuclear power plant?
Yeah, it actually sort of does. And that's one of the big challenges of robotics in general, especially intelligent robotics, is that as humans, it's easy for us to do, you know, simple things like pick up a box and move it somewhere without walking into a wall. But we take for granted our ability to do that because in a robot, we have sensors and we have all these different things that we can use to detect the environment. But aggregating all of that data together to make simple decisions that humans do is actually pretty challenging in a robot. So, to answer your question, if they knock over one of these windmills, or you know, and it causes a cargo spill, then they're going to be docked you know, some points for it, and that's part of the whole scoring scheme in the competition. So.
Well, our listeners, of course, are trying to figure out how you're doing this with joysticks and with all other kinds of monitors. But I really want you to explain to us that these robots are self-contained. I mean, you just tell them what to do, and you leave them alone, and you can't go adjust them once they begin their tasks. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So basically, each team will bring their robot, and they'll place it on the field in one of the valid starting locations, which is pretty much the entire field, other than the very middle where the containers start out.
Okay.
And once the competition round, once they're given the green light, they basically will turn a switch on and step away. And for up to the 3 or 4 minutes that the competition time runs, they won't be allowed to touch it or control it through wireless means or anything like that. It's completely onboard, self-contained behavior.
Now, what do these robots weigh? I mean, they're not real big, are they?
They're not very big. I think the maximum weight we have is 50 pounds. I might be wrong on that, but it's that would be really huge, and really heavy, and we don't really anticipate anyone to meet the upper bounds of that. But in general, they weigh the heaviest one that I've ever seen from a previous competition probably weighed as much as maybe 4 textbooks, so maybe 20 to 25 pounds, and we don't really anticipate anybody to go higher than that, but they certainly can if they want to.
So the person that's competing in the competition takes the robot, sets it down in the design places, throws a switch, and there the robot's programmed to go ahead and move around these windmills and handle these various different elements and put them in the correct places and do it in the shortest amount of time, and that is what wins the competition. Is that right?
That's right, plus the added energy efficiency bonus. So you basically get a little modifier for your score if you finish within the top 3 on the energy efficiency challenge. And
Now, how do you measure the energy efficiency again? Really explain that to us.
Okay, so the energy efficiency challenge, all of these robots are required to use battery power. Mm-hmm. And the energy efficiency challenge is optional, but a team that chooses to participate in that and finishes in the top 3 gets the bonus points. Now, how it generally works, if you choose to participate in this part of the competition, you're required to use a certain type of battery connector between the battery and the rest of the electronics on your robot. So what we've done is designed a device that hooks up in between the battery and the rest of the electronics on the robot, and this device will actually measure the amount of current and voltage that are going through the robot throughout the competition. And what it'll do is store this information, and once the run is over, we'll be able to hit a stop button on it, and it will go through and calculate the entire amount of power that the robot has expended. And that power will actually be measured in watts, much like a light bulb or one of your appliances at home is measured in. So we can tell how many watts that the robot has expended, and based on certain parameters that the based on certain objectives that the team completes, they get bonus points corresponding to their energy efficiency.
Okay, what kind of batteries are generally used? I mean, batteries have been slowly been developing over the past several years, and even now they're not considered to be the ideal that we'd like. So what kind of batteries are your competitors using?
Yeah, in general, we're probably expecting a lot of lithium polymer batteries. Mm-hmm. They're also referred to as LiPo. So these are getting popular now in the remote control car industry, amongst hobbyists and things like that. They're pretty small, and they have a lot of power density, meaning that they provide a lot of power for their size. We'll probably also see lots of NiCad batteries. These were pretty much the old standard of remote control cars. Mm-hmm. You could buy these at Radio Shack nowadays, along with the LiPo batteries. So pretty much we expect to see any kind of battery that would go in a remote control car. Those are just really convenient for this sort of scale of robot, and I think we'll see a lot of those. We may also see some lead batteries, like automotive car batteries. Well, maybe motorcycle batteries, because they're smaller. It would probably be hard to design a robot that would fit within the weight constraints if you used an entire car battery. But we could possibly see one of those. We've seen a couple in the past, but I think for the most part we're going to see the NiCad and LiPo batteries for remote control cars.
You probably don't need the amperage that you'd get from an automobile battery anyway, really, with the stuff that you're using, right?
Generally, no. And a team that would Well, if a team chose to implement that sort of power system, then chances are they wouldn't do too good in the energy efficiency challenge. So, you know, we'll see. But it's possible. You never rule anything out. Every year there's always some really out there entries that, you know, some of them do really well. So we'll see. I'm excited to see what kind of entries we have.
It sounds to me like the entries, you know, really single individuals. It sounds like you really have to have a composition of computer engineers, electrical engineers, and mechanical engineers working together to design one of these competing robots. Is that right?
Yeah, you're right. For the most part, the average team size is probably between 3 and 10 people on on the upper side. So the years that that we competed here at UTA, we had teams of three to five people every year. And I think three people is probably about the minimum that you want on a team. And the reason is that robots are basically three different fields merged together. You have mechanical engineering, which is, you know, designing the chassis and the frame structure and any sort of manipulators that the robot has. You have electrical engineering, which is designing all the circuits and integrating the sensors and whatnot. And then you have the computer engineering, which is designing the artificial intelligence aspect of the robot. So you really need those three core components in order to do this competition well. And it's really hard to do it if you're missing one of those. You know, computer people, I can speak for us, sometimes we don't do the mechanical things very well, and we tend to take that for granted until you actually have to design something like that. So it's really important to have a balanced team in this. It's, you know, definitely going to help teams if they have those sort of skills.
Well, that artificial intelligence, of course, is fascinates me. I mean, the robots don't have the ability to recognize different situations. Now, which is the most challenging for you, automation or navigation?
Well, it's a good question. So one of the things we did at the competition this year where we've sort of deviated with the past, used to in the competition, there was generally black lines on a white background all over the floor, so the teams could basically get from any point on the any point of interest on the competition field to another point. For instance, wherever the cargo containers originated, you could follow a line, you know, in some sort of fashion to get to where they needed to be delivered. Now, the teams over the years have gotten really good at that, and to be honest, it's just not really that exciting anymore. So this year, we have black lines that help for navigation, but they aren't continuous. So you can't actually get from the middle where the cargo starts to the corners where the cargo needs to be delivered by following a line. They're not continuous. So we have the flashing lights on the corners the teams can use as references for, you know, the corner positions. And the robots can use some sort of, you know, intelligent position measuring to basically get their position relative to those lights. They can also use the lines on the floor to an extent, but it's more of landmarks rather than following, you know, a road or something like that. So once they get to that certain location where a line is, they'll know for sure that they're at that location, but it's the trouble is getting there in the first place. Now, in terms of automating all of these processes, the navigation is a central component of that, so they're really sort of one and the same. A team that can't really find their way anywhere won't be able to do any of the automation tasks well, mainly because of the lack of the continuous lines.
Well, the University of Texas at Arlington is a leader in robotics research at the Automation and Robotics Research Institute. And someone asked me the question the other day, you know, really, what use are robots? I mean, you know, they're in the assembly lines for automobiles and other things that we're using them. But, I mean, why develop independent robots with intelligence when we're probably not going to have them coming and cleaning our house the way we used to see in the Jetsons and that sort of thing? So, well, what possible use is developing these robots?
Well, the sort of old industrial automation robots that you think of, you know, when you think of car factories and things like that, really, that's at a mature stage, so you'll continue to see more automation and more, you know, manufacturing done by robotics, but for the most part, there's not a whole lot of new things going on there. But the new way in robotics is autonomous mobile robotics, in addition to many other fields, but that's the one that we tend to focus on here. So now with, you know, some of the some of the fighting abroad and whatnot, the military is interested in autonomous robots for, logistical things as well as combat. But there's also a lot of civilian uses now. Search and rescue is a big deal. So when you have these big natural disasters like they had in New Orleans and like they've had currently in Haiti, you end up with a situation where there's a lot of people that need help in a really short amount of time, this sort of a critical phase where, you know, if you don't act quickly, then the death toll ends up being much bigger. So one of the things that they want to be able to do is send in swarms of lots of cheap and small robots that they don't necessarily have to have all of the really expensive sensing capabilities that a modern military robot has, but they'll be able to network with each other and exchange information, and using some relatively cheap sensors, they'll be able to aggregate all this data as a one cohesive group and be able to find people and maybe even organize rescue efforts with humans and with other robots. So it's really interesting. The new wave is basically this this idea of swarm robotics and cooperative robotics, and that's where you're going to see things really start changing here. So,
and do you see a time when robots will replace man space flight and help in space exploration? We're already using that a little bit. There's robots on Mars and that sort of thing. So, but do you see maybe getting man out of the manned space flight program and it all go to robots?
Yeah, I don't know if it'll ever completely replace manned space flight. And the reason I say that is because actually some of the first major accomplishments in space flight, especially, getting to the moon and getting out of the Earth's atmosphere and all that, they were all unmanned. In fact, the first space shuttle flights were done without humans on board. They were done basically remotely controlled. So the difference here is that those first steps that we took in those unmanned systems were, generally used remote controls that were piloted from pilots on the ground. But now, we're trying to get to Mars, we're trying to get beyond there. The speed that it takes for a radio signal to go from Earth to those places is too slow for a person to have complete control over something. So these autonomous behaviors are going to be critical into, exploring sort of the outer reaches of our solar system and beyond.
I have to stop you there, and there'll be more on this in the next half hour. And you remember to download the next half hour if you're listening online. All right, we got to get out of here now for the break of the half hour in Science News Headlines. Before we do, here's Pam Bailey with Tiny Tech Jobs and the latest job market for us. What have you got, Pam?
Well, here's one for a facility manager at 4D Labs, which is located in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
The nanofabrication facility at 4D Labs includes a Class 100 clean room as well as associated fabrication and analysis equipment. And this facility manager will be responsible for planning the ongoing operation and maintenance of that facility and seeing that these plans are achieved successfully within given deadlines. It's a big job. Applicants for the position of facility manager should have a relevant degree or some kind of experience in an engineering or science discipline with experimental and analytical techniques. The successful candidate is going to need to be able to learn, understand, and use a broad array of equipment that's related to materials fabrication and characterization. And they will also need at least 3 or 4 years of management experience.
Okay, well, that sounds like a really great job. And before we break, I needed to tell you about my friend who's a Texas cattleman, and he was explaining to a friend from Vermont that at his ranch he could start driving in the morning and not reach the far boundary of his land until the next evening.
Oh.
And you know the guy from Vermont said? He said, yeah, he said, I used to own a car like that too. All right. For more information on this and other Tiny Tech Jobs, it's tinytechjobs.com. Thanks, Pam. We'll check in with you next week. We appreciate it.
Okay, Colonel. Talk to you soon.
Okay. As we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers, will we meet today?
Andrew Tobias. The problem with borrowing money is that as soon as one has, one inevitably begins to think of it as one's own. One becomes used to it, treats it like family, and may even come to resent or lose sight of the fact that it must all someday leave to visit someone else.